Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come.
Is this on? Is this on? Hello? Are you ready? You all ready too? Okay, all right. Just make sure. Just have to trust faith. Good morning. Could everyone that has an order of service do something for me real quick? Flick to the back page, the very back cover, where you're going to find the seven Unitarian Universalist principles. And note that the fourth one on that list calls us to affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. So that'll kind of set the stage for what we're going to do today. As Unitarian Universalists, doesn't that quest to find truth and meaning come with the territory? Do we show up on Sunday morning to listen to dogma, to be told the way it was, the way it is, and the way it shall be? No, I don't think so. Speaking for myself, I wake up every morning expecting to learn something new that day, waiting for the answer to an unasked question. And to that end, our own Reverend John Lou Johnstone is ready, willing, and more than able to answer some pretty deep questions this morning. These questions were submitted by members of the congregation. We'll get to that a little bit later on. To start things off this morning, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We are a welcoming and curious congregation and are truly excited to see our numbers growing. If you are a guest and would like to keep informed about the goings-on of the fellowship, I'd encourage you to sign the guest book out on the welcoming table in the narthex just outside the sanctuary. And if you're curious about what we're all about or what Unitarian Universalism is like, I encourage you to talk with people after the service. Everyone is invited to join us immediately following the service in the ALSOP room just down the hallway a little bit and to your left. Then I'd like to call your attention to several announcements, a couple in the order of service. One, the spring work day, very important time. We do twice a year to clean up and tend to the grounds as well as the building. Is happening next Saturday, April 8th at 9 a.m. I think running till noon, if that's right, and then a potluck lunch. Yeah, at noon. And really, every year we have some people show up, but we really need some people and then some. So bring a friend. It's very important and fun, believe it or not. And also of importance, on Sunday, April 23rd, following the service, we have an annual meeting. And you can read more about that in your order of service again. So, and then the final announcement is regarding the Flint Hills Wisdom Keepers Gathering. A great indigenous cultural event is coming up the last weekend of this month, April 28th through the 30th. It's the annual Flint Hills Wisdom Keepers Gathering at White Memorial Camp near Council Grove, Kansas. So you see Diane Barker or Pat Embers. Pat Embers, I don't think Diane's here yet. She will be. She's usually late, but that's okay, for flyers and information. You can register for 1, 2, or 3 days. There is a sacred drum workshop to make your own elk hide drum, and discounts are available. The registration for the gathering is Saturday, April 15th, coming up soon, and drum workshop registration is this Friday, April 7th. Flyers for the website and Native American elders and presenters are in our in the ALSOP room, the wooden holder at the back of the room, and on the bulletin board, again, just in the hallway on your left. And again, please see Pat or Diane for more. And when you're looking for the flyer, oh, I touched it. This is what it looks like. This is what you're looking for. Okay, so sounds interesting. So now the lighting of the chalice. And words by Betts Weinecke. May this flame, symbol of transformation since time began, fire our curiosity, strengthen our wills, and sustain our courage.
This is We Whose Journeys Are Always Beginning, adapted from Marnie Harmony. We whose journeys are always beginning, we whose mission always awaits us, we whose visions are bent on loving, we gather together here. We gather as a community drawn together out of common need, each toting our own carpet bag of treasures and dreams. We gather together seeking meaning, yearning to understand life in all its dimensions as it challenges and expands, as it burdens, as it consoles and heals. We gather together with questions, the kind of questions that provoke us to the path of action. We gather with hope, the kind of hope that pulses on through uncertainty. We gather with tenderness, the kind of tenderness that can only be born from knowing human capabilities as well as human imperfections. We gather wanting certainty and having none, but we are wakeful to possibilities as we seek discernment and gentle judgment. We gather then, unbound but close. We gather thirsting. We gather drawn to our source, our Creator.
Please rise in body or spirit and join us in singing opening hymn number 90, From All the Fret and Fever of the Day. Now is the time in our service when we share those significant joys and sorrows we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. Please wait for the microphones so that all can hear you.
Ann Cowan here. I am very sad today to announce the death of my good friend and best boss ever, Jackie Rawlings. She died Friday. And I know that many of you came across her path as she was director of rehab at the hospital here from 1965 until her retirement several years ago. She died of cancer.
Jess Finkmeyer. A few weeks ago, I think I told you that I got casted in the school play. Hopefully I did. So on the 19th, the 20th, and the 21st of April is our show dates. So I would love if all of you guys would attend.
Last Sunday, I was at the UU Fellowship in Vancouver, Washington, across from Portland with Sheila, and it looks exactly like this room. I felt so at home there, and Sheila felt very at home, and it was we had gone to Portland, which was across the river. This one was only a few blocks from her house, and I think she's really interested in going to that one. So it was a real pleasure to be there.
Okay. We honor those joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken. And now it's time for the story of all ages. And for the first time, I'm going to give it a whirl, but it's been a while since I've read to kids and grandkids, so excuse my rustiness. Good morning. How's everybody doing? Good? Good. Other than the rain, you ready for the rain to stop for a little while? Yeah, get outside, breathe some fresh air. So this story is called Answer Mountain. Long ago and far away, or yesterday and just around the corner, or maybe somewhere halfway in between, there was a town that sat quiet and content, tucked into the shadow of a mountain. And carved on the side of the mountain, on that mountain, big and tall, so nobody could miss them, were the words. Come on. The answer is no. No one knew where the words came from or why they were there. They'd just always been there. But oh my goodness, the people who lived in that town cuddled into that mountain were glad to have those words there. Because whenever the townspeople had a question, all they had to do was look up at the mountain and read it. And the answer was always no. Making decisions was very simple. And life went on smoothly and easily in the town, cuddled into that mountain, until one day. Now, on that particular day, Ma Custis was about to make dinner for her family, and she just couldn't decide, because sometimes you can't, whether to make stew or steak, pasta or potatoes, dumplings or donuts. I'd vote for donuts. So she went out into the yard. Should I make liver for dinner tonight, she asked, and look up at the mountain. And the mountain said, the answer is no. All right, I knew that, really. Nobody is crazy about liver. But maybe I should make steak for dinner. And the mountain said, the answer is no. Should I make chicken? And the mountain said, the answer is no. Should I make tacos or tofu, baked beans or broccoli, pork chops or popcorn? The mountain said nothing but, the answer is no. Ma Custis asked more questions until the sun disappeared behind the mountain. She kept on asking questions until the sun came up around the other way, and all the mountain ever said was, the answer is no. Because Ma couldn't get an answer that was any kind of answer, she and her family went all night and all the next day and all the next night without dinner. Finally, Ma just gave up and made liver anyway. And she was in trouble, even though the mountain said no, and even though everybody hated liver, because liver was the first thing she thought of. But Ma Custis had had enough. She glared at the mountain, stomped her foot, and shook her fists. Why is the answer always no? Why can't you just say yes for once? Ma turned around and stomped away to ring the town bell and call a town meeting. Well, when that bell rang, the whole town came running. From the oldest man with the longest beard to the youngest kids who still needed carrying, no one would miss a town meeting. They all came, they all listened carefully as Ma Custis told her story. Seems to me, she said, that we've got a problem. That mountain just isn't helping us like it should. Seems to me it would be nice if it would say yes for a while. The townsfolk knew Ma Custis had a point, but they didn't much like that idea, changing something that had been the same for so long. But after they thought and then thought some more, they finally nodded solemnly. The mountain would have to be recarved. That's a pretty big decision, to recarve a mountain. Mason Sharp, the stone carver, nodded along with the rest of them. He scratched his nose, adjusted his cap, and slowly gazed up the length of the mountain. Then he cleared his throat and said in his gravelly voice, "Looks to me like I could do the carving, if that's all right with you." And so it was. Mason spent the next 2 weeks on the side of the mountain chiseling and chipping and carving away and coming down only when it got too dark to see. And when he was done, the mountain said, the answer is yes. Mason rang the bell to call the town meeting, and once again they all came running, from the oldest woman with the whitest hair to the youngest kids who still needed carrying. And they all wanted to see the new sign, and they all wanted to cheer for the stone carver and all his hard work. Ma Custis, who had started all of this, came right up to the front of the crowd. She figured she ought to be the person to ask the first question of this new and different mountain. Since she had discovered the problem with the old one, she stepped right up to the foot of the mountain, looked up to the top, and asked, "Should I make liver tonight?" And the mountain said, "The answer is yes." Well, now Ma Custis almost fell over with surprise. I don't know why, but Ma's a little slow. But Pa Custis told me he'd never forgive me if I served liver again, and all my kids threatened to hide in the barn for a week. Should I really serve liver? And the mountain said, the answer is yes. The townspeople began to grumble. They didn't like the sound of this. Ma Custis's family grumbled the loudest. "But, well, I can't," Ma said. "I mean, I just can't serve liver again. I promised I wouldn't. Are you telling me I should break my promise?" The mountain said, the answer is yes. Grumbling got louder, and Ma Custis, well, she glared at the mountain again, stamped her foot and shook her fist again, and she turned to the townspeople and said, "This just isn't right. This just can't be right. What are we going to do?" Once again, the townsfolk put on their thinking caps. Everybody thought, Ma Custis, Pa Custis, and all the Custis kids, who probably thought the hardest of all because they were worried about the liver. Very worried about the liver. Finally, the smallest but one of the Custis kids piped up, "Why does there have to be just one answer? Can't we have more?" The townspeople gasped. No one had thought of such a thing before. They mumbled and grumbled and talked amongst themselves. Finally, they decided that the mountain ought to say, "The answer is sometimes yes, and sometimes no, and sometimes wait and see, and sometimes I just don't know." Mason the stone carver, who had been listening to all this talk, cleared his throat, scratched his nose, adjusted his cap, and said, "I think I can do it. I don't mind, not really, even if I did just finish carving the new change. But, well, it's going to take a while, and I can't work all day and all night. Like I did last time, so how about if I work on it when I can, and I'll just hang up some sort of sign on the mountain that lets people know that the answer is coming." And so it was. The funny thing was that for a little while, Mason worked on the mountain every day and night, and for a while, everyone in town waited eagerly to see the new answer. But soon the stonemason got tired of climbing the mountain every day, and everyone else got tired of waiting. And they all started asking each other questions and helping everyone find answers that seemed to fit. The townspeople realized that the different questions usually had different answers, that sometimes the same question had more than one answer, and that there were many more answers than they had imagined. And all of that was fine with them. After a while, they thought that maybe the answer to the mountain was giving them right then, just as it was better and more sensible than any other answer it had given. And so they left it as it was. And the mountain said, "The answer is under construction." The end. So do we really want a mountain or anything else telling us what the answer is? Shouldn't you think about the question first, then give answers that fit the question? Doesn't that make more sense? So don't look at a mountain when you have a question. Thanks for putting up with my rustiness, and we'll see you all in a little while.
Go in love.
Morning. As you probably all know, Chris Bailey and I have been working on pledging this year. We've been trying different things in pledging and stewardship the last few years, and this year we tried to get our pledging done early. So we have been in the process this past month of pledging for next fiscal year, starting in June through the next May. Our goal this year was just to get increased numbers of pledges. We have no requirement that people pledge money in this fellowship for membership. Some churches do. We don't. But we are in covenant with each other. We take care of each other. We take care of this community. We take care of this fellowship and the organization. And we work together to take care of the community outside these doors. So if you haven't pledged yet for next fiscal year, I encourage you to get a pledge in. If you haven't been pledging lately, I encourage you to think about that. I ask you to just consider what you can do for this community. I know you probably are already doing things for this community, right? You care about this community, right? So I urge you to consider to make a pledge, to write it down, right? To put some combination of what you want to do with your time, what you can contribute in with your talent, what kinds of things you'd like to work on, and what you might be able to add in terms of financial gifts. Everything matters here. And know that whatever you do give, however small or large, whatever your situation is, whatever capabilities you have, we all appreciate what we each put in together. Thank you.
Thanks, Renee, as always. I'm not sure where else in town you can go and hear that on Sunday morning, so it kind of adds to the... So we're at the part of the service that we're just calling generically questions and answers. And it's something new, as far as I know. It's never been done in this format anyway.
Never been done here.
Yeah, okay. Stand correct. Never been. I thought we had something like world record type thing here. We'll probably do it best of everybody, but not the first time. Reverend Johnstone is going to answer all your questions. Questions about life, the universe, and everything. Assuming those questions were submitted ahead of time. We ask the congregation to submit questions that John Lou might be able to tackle this morning. And we received some great ones, so we'll spend a little while learning what we can. Since the questions were submitted in writing before today, we'll display them up on the wall. And mostly verbatim. There might be some slight paraphrasing, very slight, or a shortening if it's a long question. And I'll read the entire question even if it is long. But again, we'll just display what we can. And we do have a guest speaker coming up to answer one of those questions. We know that the answers to the questions may or will spark more questions and discussion. And if we have time, John will attempt to field follow-up questions, but not until she's gotten through all of the ones that were submitted. If we can't get to those today, I think everyone is aware that John Lou is available throughout the week at Radina's, at her regular Radina's hours that she publishes weekly. And she's here, around here, let her know. Okay, so we've included a couple of sessions of Q&A broken up by a hymn dedicated, designed to help clear everyone's mind. So with that, away we go.
Questions and answers.
Question number one. Oh, no. In honor of Women's History Month, who do you believe are three of the most important and or remarkable women, remarkable UU women in history?
Of course, Women's History Month was technically last month, March, but that doesn't stop me from answering this question. And I love this question. This is wonderful. And I could name any number of fabulous UU women, Margaret Fuller, so forth and so on. But I'm going to narrow it down to three because they asked that. The first one that I'd like to talk about is Queen Isabella Jagiellon, who was a 16th century Polish woman married to a king in Hungary, and her husband died very young. She had a young son, John Sigismund, who you may have heard of, and he became the king of Transylvania, the only Unitarian king in history. And she, too, was a Unitarian. She brought Unitarianism to Hungary. She ruled as his regent for many, many years, and actually, under his name, issued an edict of religious toleration for her kingdom so that you could be Lutheran or Calvinist or Unitarian rather than just having to follow the rule of the realm. So I think Queen Isabella is somebody who we definitely need to remember. Olympia Brown. How many of you have heard of Olympia Brown? You really have to know something about Olympia Brown. She was one of the first ordained women in this country who was recognized by a denomination. In 1863, she was ordained as a Universalist. She served congregations primarily in the Midwest, especially the Racine congregation, which is now the Racine, Wisconsin congregation, which is now called the Olympia Brown Church after her. Another important thing about her is that she kind of stepped down from ministry in order to do tours and talks about women's suffrage. And she did, one of her tours was through Kansas, actually. She rode in wagons and stopped in towns and stood on the back of the wagon and talked about women's suffrage. And she is one of the few original suffragists who actually got an opportunity to vote. As a very old woman, well over 80, she was able to cast her first vote. So Olympia Brown, I think, is somebody who we want to keep in mind. And the other person I would bring to mind is Sophia Lyon Foss. In the 20th century, she was a Unitarian religious educator and developed much of the curriculum that came into being in the 20th century. Brought science into Unitarian Universalist religious education, brought the sense of awe and wonder in relation to science and the natural world, brought many cross-cultural myths and ideas, stories, so that expanding things well beyond the Christian tradition. And so I think she's a really important person for us to remember because she has shaped much of what Unitarian and Unitarian Universalist religious education became. So Sophia Lyon Foss is one that I would honor. And if you want to know more, at least during Women's History Month on the UUA.org website, they had up some things on celebrating UU women in history, and there's a whole bunch of women you can learn about.
Who are some of the individuals in our collective past who weathered times like these and have words of wisdom for us?
You know, I mentioned Olympia Brown, and I would look to some of those suffragists because they, most of them did die before they got a chance to vote, and yet their words and their actions continued on. I would look to some of the abolitionists because they were envisioning a whole new world, a world without slavery. If you imagine growing up in a world with slavery, that idea of envisioning a world without slavery was radical. So people like Frederick Douglass and that kind of, and those kind of Harriet Tubman and those folks. Certainly the civil rights movement in this country, looking to people like King. And looking to Eastern Europe before the communists fell. And I have particular words that I've written down here that are from Vaclav Havel. Hope is a state of mind, not of the world. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good. To work for something because it is good. So I think those words of Vaclav Havel are very apt for today's world, working for something because it is good. That idea that we can't be too attached to the results, we have to just do what's right.
Can you talk a bit about our strategic planning committee, what our strategic planning committee has been up to?
Well, let's let Kathleen talk about that since she's chairing that committee.
Guest speaker. So strategic planning, where we take the answer is no and make it, maybe move it towards the answer is maybe or possibly or maybe yes someday. So what has strategic planning been doing? For the past year, we've been looking at short, medium, and long-range issues for the fellowship that need some attention in TLC. This is our document that we've been working from. How did we come to this? We started with a visioning process. It's been about a year. We started with a pie-in-the-sky look at UUFM in the next 10 to 20 years, and we used our vision statement to guide us in this process and to narrow it down. How do we look as a beacon in the community? Are we welcoming? Is our space adequate? Are we meeting the needs of our congregants in the sanctuary and meeting spaces? Are the children in adequate spaces in their classrooms? How's our location? Are we visible in the community? Have we been good stewards to our facilities? If we grow, do we have the space or just the parking spaces for more, or even just the parking spaces for more people? So very quickly, our group was able to focus down on concerns of physical facilities here. There's a lot of things on that list, and we had input from the board and the facilities committee and RE. So we came up with this document to identify short, mid, and long-range goals. We shared it with the board, and then we had a meeting with the congregation that the congregation was invited to participate in. We had initially placed a site assessment in the mid-range goals, so the 6 to 24 months goals. But after that fall meeting, it was very clear from congregational input that we should move that up to a short-range goal. So the board approved use of money from the growth fund. That's just money set aside for use in growth-related projects. And with full-time ministry, we have been thinking about growth as a possibility. We hired BBN Architects. It's a local architect firm. They have an office down by the mall, and to perform an assessment. And Brent and Dan met with us on several occasions to assess what we currently have, and opportunities, if any, for expansion, including the sanctuary, the kitchen, the classrooms, office space, and parking. We also asked for alternative concepts of expansion, one that would allow for flexibility of space, repurposing of existing space, and we asked them to consider green and sustainable practices with an expansion. They came up with some design ideas for us to show what some possibilities could be. So some people had worried whether our current location would consider a major expansion. We now have some ideas on how that can happen. After the service, I have some posters that are in the back, and I'll have them on display out here that if just to see what they showed us, that there are possibilities for expansion in this space. But staying in this space doesn't get us physically closer to the center of Manhattan, which is something that would really help with our vision. We'd certainly be more visible in the community. So we are still exploring possibilities for this to see what the options might be. We have plans to talk with a local realtor about available sites or even lots that would get us closer into town. A small group of us met with a small group of the Mennonite congregation to explore the possibility of a shared space. They own property at 9th and Points that's currently vacant. They had also hired BBN Architects to do a site plan for a new build at that site. It was a very interesting conversation, and I do look forward to having another conversation with them someday soon. One of their ministers is going to be coming for a pulpit exchange this May. So this is where we find strategic planning. We are meeting again coming this upcoming week. Please share with me or any members of the committee. It's Bryce Hobrock, Nathan Albin, Jonathan Mahorny, Molly McGoy, Mark Clark, Sylvia Beeman. I know I'm missing somebody. And then we've
Matt
been having
Campbell.
Yep, Matt Campbell and John Lou have been attending as well. So these are just ideas and recommendations that we have. These are not plans that have been put into place. If we have any recommendations, they'll go through the board first. So thanks.
I'd just add to that somebody approached me this morning with a question. Yes, it's against the rules, but the question that he had was, what makes the difference in growth? Why do some churches grow and others not? And I think there are a couple of factors that I think are really important. One is commitment, that people decide they really are committed and they want to make a difference. And that means commitment in terms of their time, of their energy, of their money. And the other thing is flexibility, being able to adapt to new and different circumstances. He had another answer that I won't tell you because I'll tell you. He said it's having a smart and dynamic minister. And I said, there may be some truth to that, but I have certainly seen situations where smart and dynamic ministers were not enough. So, okay.
My mother is aging, and with others dying around her, becoming more aware of her mortality. I don't know what to say to her. How do people engage in these conversations? How do you?
This is some of the most important stuff we do in our lives, isn't it? Really? This is some, because mortality is one of the things that, as human beings, we all share. This is something that is really a very important thing. And it is important to talk about it. Whenever somebody starts talking about their mortality or the mortality of those around them as they see friends dying, as they see parents dying, I think it's important for us to take a deep breath and not be afraid of going there, to not be afraid of addressing the practical concerns. Well, as you grow older, what do you envision for yourself? Would you rather be in a nursing home, or do you want to work out something with the family? What do you want to be remembered for? What's the legacy that you want to leave to us? What in particular do you want? Do you want to be cremated? What do you want in terms of if you're if you're in a position where you become unable to make decisions for yourself, help me know what you would want. Do you want extraordinary measures? And I really think it's important to have these conversations, to ask questions, to listen for the answers. My own mother is extremely practical, and she makes sure that she tells me on a regular basis to not leave her plugged into anything. And at least annually, she goes through her financial folder with me so that I know where things are, what's going on. A lot of times we're reluctant to do those things because it's an acknowledgement of our mortality, but our mortality is inevitable. Whatever else may happen to us in this life, we will die. And so not only is this significant and difficult, but it's also precious. Because if we can engage with those pieces around dying, we're really engaging with the pieces around living. And we're really engaging with, what are your values? Who are you? What do you want to leave to us? So it's precious moments, very precious moments. So I hope that's helpful.
What's the best way to tell a serious Christian that one is an atheist?
These conversation things are some of the most difficult things in our lives, aren't they? the first thing that I would think about is why. Why do you want to tell this person? Because that's going to be a major determinant of the best way to do it. Is it because this person is close to you and you want to share something of yourself because you're a close friend and you want them to know who you really are and not who they might think you are? In that case, you're going to approach it perhaps in a different way than if it's a matter of they're having prayer circles all the time at your workplace and you really don't want to be included. You know, that would be a different kind of conversation than the conversation with somebody who you're trying to make a connection with. So one of the important things I think to keep in mind in this is to not put down Christianity in mass as you say that. You need to be able to say it, to speak from your point of view without saying, and that's what you should believe too, and even to imply that. So if it's a matter of a prayer circle, you might say, I appreciate you inviting me, but I'm not Christian. In fact, I don't even believe in God, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to participate. If it's a matter of somebody who you really care about that you want to explain more of who you are to them, then I think it's something you approach in a very loving and kind way, where you say, because we're so close and I want to keep our relationship close and I want to go deeper with our relationship, there are some things you need to know about me. You need to know that I don't believe in God. I think it's fine that you do, but I don't. And to be able to listen in any of those situations, to listen back. So I hope that's helpful. Appreciate their serious Christianity, but make a distinction with your own thoughts.
What are strategies we can use to communicate in these polarized times when we honestly believe, based on facts, that the person we are speaking to is misinformed, especially with best friends?
Yeah, because if they're not best friends, just don't even bother. If the relationship isn't important in some way, then you probably don't want, you may not even want to engage with it, really. Strategies we can use. Whenever I think about communication with people, I go back to the Buddhist idea of right speech. And one of the things that comes out of that idea is to look at things with four questions whenever you want to speak with somebody. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it useful? And is this the best time and place? If you can stick with those rules, you can pretty much have any conversation. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it useful? And is it the right time and place? So with these conversations, I'd keep that stuff in mind, and I'd keep in mind I need to speak from I statements. I need to reflect what I think and believe, not accusatory statements like, you're really being misled on this. That's not helpful. It might be true, but it's not useful. It's not helpful. It might not be kind. So especially if it's somebody who we care about, speaking with I statements, listening as much as we talk, these are really, really hard conversations. Practicing beforehand. I did, for a while I was meeting with a nonviolent communication group, and that's what we did. We would get together and we would practice speaking. We would especially practice difficult conversations we wanted to have with other people. So you might sit down with somebody who you trust and say, let me just run this by you. How do you think so-and-so will hear this if I say this to them? So I believe in that kind of practice, especially with really difficult, important conversations. So I hope some of those strategies are helpful.
Thanks. And a similar note, what are some strategies we can use to be active, effective, yet keep our peace of mind?
I had a conversation with Renee this morning where she was saying that she was being distracted from news lately by thinking about ducks. So if you have any questions at all about ducks, Renee is the person to talk to. Having something to distract yourself can be useful. Having something to distract yourself can be useful. Somebody used the metaphor of being in a choir. And if you've ever been in a choir and learned to sneak breaths, so you might breathe in unexpected places, but just making sure that when you're breathing is not when everybody else is breathing. So that's a piece, is to figure in those breaks, but figure in those breaks recognizing that those around you are continuing. Because if you don't take those breaks, you're not going to be able to maintain the effort. So to be active and effective, we have to have breaks from it. We have to breathe when others are carrying on the tune. We have to prioritize. We have to think about what is most important in this to me, not what's most important to anybody else. What's most important to me? Is climate change the issue that's most important to me? Is immigration the issue that's most important to me? Focusing our efforts on those things that we're most passionate about will help to feed us. So we don't have to do everything on everything. We don't have to. That's not necessary. It won't even work in the long run. So I think that it's important to prioritize according to what we think is most important and recognize that not everybody is going to be doing the same things that you are. And that it's okay to be having these different strategies. It's okay to be working on different issues. There are times that we may want to all come together on some particular thing. But if we don't keep our own priorities in mind, we're not going to be able to maintain for the long haul. So that's what I'd say. And being sure to take those breaks. Think about ducks. or something.
So ducks. Ducks is the answer. Thanks. Well, we've reached halftime.
Oh.
And we tried to get a hold of Lady Gaga, but she's still unavailable. So our halftime entertainment is you, all of you people. So please rise as you are able and join in singing 145 As Tranquil Streams.
As tranquil streams that meet and merge and flow as one to seek the sea, our kindred hearts and minds unite to build a church that shall be free. Free from the bonds that bind the mind to narrow thought and lifeless.
Round two. Is it true that you can become a different person, a different personality, different core beliefs, different interests, likes, and dislikes, by dedicating yourself to pretending to be that other person and by acting as if you were that other person, i.e., does the concept of fake it till you make it, or you become what you pretend to be, actually work?
Well, yes and no. This is definitely a yes and no question. If there is a particular aspect of your life that you are really motivated to change, to be kinder because people in your life are complaining that you're not, or to quit drinking if you discover you're alcoholic, if there is a particular thing in your life that you're extremely motivated to change, then fake it till you make it can work. If you decide that instead of being the kind of person who watches 2 hours of sitcoms, you're going to become the kind of person who listens to light jazz and reads deep books, you might be able to do that. If it is really consistent with your values and you determine to do it, you're not going to reconstruct your whole self. None of us can reconstruct our whole self. We have to kind of take some of what we are and move forward with that. But I think that you can make particular changes in your life, even big changes. It has to align with your true values so that it's got that natural reinforcing quality to it. It can be done in that way. I have a colleague who often says that being a minister has made him a better person than he ever intended to be. And I think there's some truth to that, because we're forced as ministers to reflect on ethics, and we're forced to reflect on how best to live our lives and some of those kinds of things. And I won't say that this happens with every minister. I won't go that far. But forcing yourself to reflect on what are my values, and are my values aligned with my action, and how can I improve how I relate with people, and some of those kinds of questions can challenge us to be better people and to make a difference in our lives. So I hope that yes and no sort of works for you.
So this is a long question. The first part is up here now, but I'll read the whole thing. How can an otherwise intelligent person believe literally in any particular religious mythology or dogma? And the questioner goes on to ask, a simple thought experiment proves that for most people, faith in a particular religious mythology is imprinted on their brains by their parents and their social group. If you were brought up Islamic, in an Islamic family and society, you'll most certainly believe Islamic myths. If the same you has been magically beamed into the body of a baby in a Christian family and society, you'll most certainly grow up preferring Christian mythology. Why don't believers in various myths think about the obvious truth of that idea and therefore realize that their brains are gardens in which any brand of partisan religion fungus could have thrived, whichever one had been planted? Verbatim.
Well, it's a complicated question. I think that for the most part, most of the people who I've met who are deeply religious in some way don't necessarily literally believe in a particular religious mythology or dogma. They believe in aspects of it. They believe in its inspirational power. But I would hold back on that literal. I think that people who are most developed religiously understand that they are embedded in a particular religious mythology and that other people have their own mythologies, but it works well for them, and so they hold on to it. It's a little bit of why I call myself a theist. It's not that I necessarily think that there is... I do better in my life if I think that there's a God than if I don't. That's my reason. I do better in my life if I conceive of life that way than when I don't. So it's a choice. I think that one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that we all have a worldview. We may not have a religious worldview. We may carry around an Enlightenment worldview. We may carry around a scientific worldview. We all carry some sort of worldview that kind of answers the questions that are unanswerable, that helps us understand the world. And because most of those things are truly unknowable, many of those things are unknown and unknowable, what the particular mythology is may not matter that much as long as it works for us. So I think that many intelligent people also, in some situations, people haven't necessarily been exposed to a lot. If they haven't been exposed to a lot, they may hold their worldview as the only worldview. But once you start exposing people, something shifts in there, and you come to a place of perhaps not literal believing. Okay.
Thanks. Tough question.
All right.
Again, a longish answer their question, so let me read the whole thing. Why do people substitute faith for reason? Do all of us deceive ourselves when we imagine that we are being impartial, dispassionate, and logical? Are all of us highly skilled in rationalizing our biases and faith-based opinions? And do all of us persuade ourselves that we believe only what logic dictates, when in fact even Unitarians might take certain myths on faith when we think we are accepting of them only after cold rational analysis? I personally don't believe that I or most Unitarian friends are guilty of this, but am I merely deceiving myself?
Yeah. I do not think that, you know, this impartial, dispassionate, and logical, those are values. Impartiality, dispassionate, logic, those are values. If you value those, then you strive to do them. You strive to be that way in the world. But that's a bias, because you're playing to those particular values. The Enlightenment came along and made a big difference in history, right? Changed a lot of things, changed a lot of the way that we think about things. And we came to view, okay, maybe there is this objective world that we're looking at and that we can study in a scientific way. Well, now more and more science is telling us that that's not really true. That an observer determines whether a wave is a particle or whether a light is a wave or a particle. The observer determines whether that is true or not. That's what science tells us. You know, Heisenberg's uncertainty, where you can get momentum, you can measure the momentum or you can measure the place, but you can't measure both at the same. We're finding that there are limits to objectivity. And the other piece about being human is that we have hearts as well as minds. We do have values. Values are not objective by their very nature. We have biases. All of us have biases. The Harvard Implicit Bias Studies are very, very interesting because they show how we have racial bias, how we have gender bias, even if we're not aware of it. And we are acting on these factors that are part of us even when we're not aware of it. Now, we can make a choice to engage in a particular methodology of thinking, whether it's scientific method or whether it's legal reasoning, which will push us toward being impartial, dispassionate, and logical. We can make that choice, but we will never be completely that way. How do you make a decision about what house you're going to buy? How do you make a decision about who you're going to marry? How do you make a decision about how you're raising your children? These are not impartial, dispassionate, logical decisions, and they're some of the most important decisions we make in our lives, because they're based in our values and they're based in our biases. So I think if we're saying that we're impartial, dispassionate, and logical, we're deceiving ourselves. Yes, I think we are. So we are all substituting faith for reason to some extent.
What do people 10, 20 years older than I am think that someone my age, early 40s, should know about, but that I don't know that I should ask about? It's an easy one.
Well, and I can appropriately answer that question because I am older than that. Yeah. I really think mortality is the biggest thing. As we age, we become more and more aware of it. I know in my early 40s, I wasn't as aware of the limited amount of time that exists that I am now. And having that awareness, I think, can make a difference. I think it's really important for people to form some friendships or mentoring relationships or something across ages. Because we can learn from those 10 or 20 years older, and by being in those relationships, we learn the things that we wouldn't think to ask about. But I also think that that's important for those of us who are older, because people who are younger have a different relationship with the world. They came up through a different set of experiences, a different kind of engagement with the world, and I learn all the time from my younger friends. So I think that having those relationships is really what matters and can make a significant difference for both sides of the generations, all sides of the generations. But my quick answer really is mortality and recognizing that we don't have all the time we think we have.
Okay. So what effort has been made by local blacks to work with us and we with the black community on issues they feel are important?
This is a really important question. And the answer is that all the efforts at this point are completely inadequate. I did go this week, and some of the rest of you may have gone this week, to the community race relations discussion. Race reconciliation, they called it. And I felt like it was a good start of a conversation. I think that there are some white people who realize that African Americans and other people of color have a different experience in Manhattan than they do. But not nearly enough people realize that. Not nearly enough people realize the differences. Of course, we've got the stuff going on with the Coalition for Equal Justice that John Extell has been working on in terms of the disparate arrest rates for marijuana of African Americans versus whites. And, I mean, that's just one little piece, one small dimension of how different the world can be for people of color than it is for white people. And in our own association right now, we have these issues going on. Some of you may be aware that Peter Morales, the president of the association, resigned this week. And he resigned in the wake of some challenges around hiring practices that many people perceive as biased toward white men, and particularly white ordained men. Because we all do have a world view and we do all have implicit biases that we don't even know about, absolutely. We have to examine ourselves. We have to examine the institutions that we're part of. All of those things are a part of recovering from racism. We're all recovering racists. In my view, because we've been raised in that world, we've been raised in that way, and it's a very difficult thing to face up to and to address. So there's a lot more to be done.
What are UUA perspectives on current issues like immigration, government health care, et cetera?
Okay. One thing that I would say is that there are steady action issues that the Unitarian Universalist Association is always engaged with, and in some congregations they make a bigger deal out of these steady action issues and do more study on them than we have tended to. The current steady action issues are the corruption of our democracy and escalating inequality. In the recent past, we've had actions around reproductive justice, immigration as a moral issue, ethical eating, and creating peace. So those are some of those issues. Immigration, I think that the association has been very strongly working on fairness and not splitting up families. The immigration system is a mess. The immigration system is a mess. And for us to continually refuse to look at comprehensive immigration reform is ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Because until that happens, it will remain a mess. They can build all the walls they want. People will find ways around them. People will overstay visas. That will happen until the system is addressed as a whole. So there is a very specific, if you look at immigration as a moral issue, there's a very specific resolution that was made and passed by our General Assembly that's online. But basically, we think we should be fair to people. Government health care, again, we should be fair to people. We should be kind. We should be sure that people are taken care of. Many of our churches have been active with Black Lives Matter and some other kinds of things like that. So there's a lot of things happening there.
And our final question this morning is regarding all the good social activism work our members do. Do they do it because of who they are and they also happen to be UU, or do they do it because they are UU? Where does member identity and personal choice responsibility converge?
That's a good question. But one of the key things about being Unitarian Universalist, I think, is having a sense of social responsibility. And so one could say that anything they do out of social responsibility is because they're UU. But not everybody would look at it that way. It depends on where that Unitarian Universalist identity falls in their own enumeration of the causes of their action, the precipitating things about their action. So I do an awful lot of my social action activist work because I'm Unitarian Universalist, because my identity is so much a part of that social action work. Other people may not see that as part of their UU identity. I think that answer is going to vary depending on individuals, as so much in our association depends on where we are as individuals. We champion those individual responses and encourage people to live in a socially responsible way, whether or not they identify it as Unitarian Universalist.
Okay, well, that's it. I'd like to thank everybody that did submit questions. Thanks to all of you for being here. Follow-up questions or discussion can be had over a cup of joe or tea. If you have any questions about ducks, this over here, sorry. And most other questions should be probably aimed towards John and Lou. So if you join us in body or spirit, hymn number 113, Where is our Holy Church?
Closing words come from Rainer Maria Rilke. Have patience with everything unresolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers which could not be given to you now, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer.